Well, everybody, I'm so excited. We get to do another shot of tequila. And even more exciting, I get to do a shot of tequila, not only with my fabulous producers, but with my brother, Eric Dimmer. Ah, the crowd goes wild. We have actually, what's super cool about today's toast is I actually have his merch that has Eric Dimmer and it has Play What You Hear on it, and it has a saxophone. It's super cool. So anyway, and of course, my trusty production team, they are ready at the helm with a shot as well. So Eric, if you want to do the famous toast that you always do, this is a throwback to your morning days, but yes. I gotta make you do it because you're so good at it.
Okay, well, follow along. It goes, arriba, abajo, al centro, dentro, that means up, down, center, clean, clear glass with your friend or neighbor on the all central portion and inside your own mouth. So all you got to do, grab your drink, put it 45 degrees in the air and repeat after me. Arriba.
Arriba.
Abajo.
Abajo.
El centro.
El centro.
Got a clink.
Clink.
A little kernel clink.
Clink.
And.
Clink.
Got it. Clink.
Perfect.
All right. And then you did throw down the hatch. And yes, I know I didn't say it right. I get people tell me that I do it wrong every day, but that's what I...
What's that? Does it go down your nose?
No, this I do the adentro. It's bidentro, but it's... I do it hokey just because it's more fun.
Okay. Whew. That was delicioso. Mm. I noticed today everybody's having a sip of water afterwards. So we've switched from our normal little plastic cups to we've graduated to the Eric Dimmer merch. So it definitely, I mine went down a lot smoother today. So I'm actually vibing with it. So okay. So welcome back, everybody, to the Feral and Fabulous podcast. I am so excited, like I was talking about earlier, to have my brother, Eric Dimmer, with us today. And oh, my gosh, the stories we could tell. Many of them we can't tell because it's because it's on a podcast.
We might get hunted down or
yes,
something.
Exactly. We might end up as a body in a closet, in somebody else's closet.
Yeah. Or in Houston, you know, with all the bodies in the bayou.
Oh, so. There you go. There you go. Yeah, that'll be the day that happens. But anyway, I don't even know where to start because there's so many things that I want to talk to you about. But I'm going to start off with, obviously, you're a fantastic, amazing musician. And ever since I ever listened to you from the very first time as a kid, basically, you were always a fantastic like artist and musician and so talented. But at what point, because I don't remember this, at what point did you decide that you wanted to go into music as a career? Like, at what point did it go from our days when we played in the Cool Cats on the Arneson River Theater? I was the lead guitarist and vocalist, and Eric did the maracas, and then our brother Shane, he was the drummer.
I was the go-go dancer.
Yeah, you were the go-go dancer? He was the go-go dancer. But anyway, that was back when they used to have talent shows and music on the Arneson. Well, maybe they still do. I don't know. But anyway, from those days, moving it forward, because you had to be, what, 5 or 6 when you were the go-go girl or the go-go guy, I guess I should say, the maracas shaker on the stage. So from there to, you know, at what point did it change from that to, hey, I think I really want to do this as my living?
Well, to start to go back just a little bit, you're saying even when I was young and first started and I was always good. Because I had to be or I was going to get in trouble.
What? So. Good point. So. Good point. That is so true.
It's very true.
Second is nothing.
Exactly.
You are nothing if you are not the best.
Yeah. Or, you know.
Yeah.
And a little backhand here or there. So, it's, you know.
It'll inspire you.
But, no, the funniest thing is, and I, you know, as, you know, playing piano early, and then had you were around David Hill, who played piano, that got me interested in doing that.
Yeah.
And then from him going to play sit in with Morning at Blue Bonnet Palace, you know, Mom taking me to go to Blue Bonnet Palace when I was 14.
Yeah.
And I shot my first beer on stage that night.
Yep.
And I was hooked.
Yeah. And on the beer or music?
Well, it's funny because somebody asked me that very same thing last night. And we were talking about stuff, and how I got started with everything. But no, what actually got me started with it is while I was up there, Jimmy Donahue, one of the singers in the band, said, I need you to move over so I can hear myself. And there was a speaker on the floor pointed up at him, and it just something about that just kind of like never even thought about it.
Yeah.
And
it opened your eyes to the whole setup of how it works.
Something about that just it just intrigued me, and then so I just wanted to learn more about it. And then I got to hang out with them a year later or so. I started hanging out, kind of being a roadie.
I remember.
And moving the gear and everything. Then they would let me get up and play little Elvis and little blues stuff with them. And
yeah.
But with Morning.
Yeah, because I remember it used to play a bunch, because I used to work there, at Reed's Red Derby, which became Maggie's. And then used to play with them all the time at Maggie's.
I think I officially started working for the band was the day I graduated high school, which I barely made it out of. I flew to Dallas. Bud was getting married. The bass player was getting married. And that was like my first official gig that I've went out to and did. So I became part of the band after that, and so I worked with them for at least 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And I learned about, you know, I was still being a roadie, but I started learning about the sound, and I remember they had a, what really got me into it is one of the guys fell asleep in the equipment truck and crashed the truck, and they had their big sound console. It still worked. Everything was intact, but it got a big old dent in the middle of it because something landed on top of it. So they were able to get a new one, and I took the old one, and I started learning about everything.
Oh, cool.
And that's how I got started with just doing the audio. And so my early years was more about being an engineer.
Yes,
and,
roadie. Sound aspect of it.
Yeah, it was all the sound things. And then eventually I moved to Houston in 88. And I was still, it's funny because I was also playing with every night. I went out every night. And that's another reason why things kind of worked out the way they did is because in 5 years, I probably stayed home maybe one night a year. Yeah. I was out every night playing with somebody.
Yes. Yes.
And that's basically what it takes.
Yeah.
You just got to be out.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
And most of the time I wasn't getting paid.
Yeah. It's hard to make a living in the beginning.
I finally decided, well, okay, I'm going to get out of here and, you know, force my way into Houston.
Yeah.
And then, sure enough, as soon as I was gone, everybody's like, hey, well, we want you to play. So finally I started getting paid. I had to go back to San Antonio. And then I started getting paid to go play. And so, but then not long after that, but I was all about sound. I was working with sound companies and everything. Yeah. And then got hooked up with a club in Houston, and called Kelso's.
Kelso's? Yeah. Oh, that was a long time ago. Yeah,
Kelso's was a long time ago, and it was basically Lone Wolf Management, the vice president of Lone Wolf, which J.W. Williams, and the silent partner was Billy Gibbons, and from ZZ, and they had the club, and I was hanging out there. I was kind of doing sound and kind of doing that.
Yeah.
And that led me into going to work for Clint Black.
Yes, that's right.
And then I
toured. That's right.
As the engineer and the schlepper and everything, I worked real hard.
I remember that you came down, and actually you were already living over there, and I think you came down, and you did you run sound for Clint Black?
Yeah.
Was it at Blue Bonnet Palace?
And Mom... with her
Mom
tea
and I
bag
went and to she, go see yeah. you at that Clint Black yeah. concert. Yep. And I do remember that actually very yeah. well. And I didn't realize I didn't realize at that time that you had already moved to Houston.
Oh yeah.
No, and that you had just come back and you yeah. were playing with him at that time. So yeah. that was kind of the official beginning.
Yep. That's kind of where everything really kind of started yeah. from there. And I toured with him for a little bit.
Yeah.
And then it was just meant for me to come back home. And then after I got done, which really won't go into what all happened on that, but,
but oh, the stories we could tell.
Oh yeah. And
well, tell me, because I can't remember the exact chronological sequence of everything, but I know at some point, fairly early on in your career, I mean, you'd been playing with people for a while, but I knew at that point you were living out of town, but you called me up and you were touring with Eric Clapton.
Well,
and
yeah,
you had said, hey, I'm playing with Clapton. And I'm like, Eric Clapton? And you know, you're like, yeah, that Eric Clapton. Yeah. And it was in the drum, I think, yeah,
in Austin.
And yeah. then I remember going up there and you got me a backstage pass, which I was like, oh my God. And then not only did I get to go backstage, but it took a while. I don't know what he was tied up taking a shower or something.
Yeah, it was just, well, I mean, it's just, you never know because, you know.
No, I get it. I yeah. get it. It's like it. You don't know what's going to lead up to that point, you but I literally.
I couldn't guarantee anybody. You can't because it's that's just.
No, I know, but it worked out so beautifully.
We're not worthy to be there, but we're there.
No.
And so.
Exactly.
You know,
but and, literally, and the tunnels were kind of like rounded, yeah. or at least I remember there's some sort of
it's kind of like Dallas, the airport. It's always, you're always going.
Is that
in
what
a
it
circle.
Is? I yeah. just remember there being a curvature to yeah. the area that I was walking in. And as I walked around, there is Eric Clapton, literally wet hair, slicked back, literally leaning up against the wall with his foot on the wall, just like chilling.
Yeah.
And I'm like, OMG, that is Eric Clapton.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh my God. And then you introduced me. I was like, you know, trying to breathe in through my nose and out through my mouth just to keep from, you know, passing out. I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing. And then I think you guys ended up getting to know each other well enough that didn't like Danielle's footprints
yeah,
end
oh,
up,
yeah,
yeah your daughter. And so tell us the story.
Craziest thing. So, you know, I got through all the stuff with Clint and about a year and a half later, I was playing and I ended up getting a call from Gate Mouth people. And because I was touring with Clarence Gate Mouth Brown.
Okay.
And which that's a whole nother, that takes a little while. That's a whole nother story.
Yeah.
How I ended up getting with him. And
yeah.
I can't really say what he said. Because
I understand.
Because it took me three different times to go be in front of him. And he didn't want to hear me. He just looked at me and says, no, get this guy out of here. And then, so finally, there was a bunch of people that said, you need to listen to him. And so he did. And then basically I started from then on, I was with him for 13, you know, up until he died. And that was from towards the end of 93 all the way till he died in 2005.
So it was through Gate Mouth Brown that he right. got the gig to
yeah,
be
was,
with Eric Clapton.
Craziest thing, because Gate lived in Slidell, Louisiana,
yeah.
and he lived practically at the House of Blues. And Clapton had just gotten through recording the From the Cradle album. And so they were playing kind of to test the waters out and everything. They were playing at the House of Blues. And so, you know, Gate being Gate, he's just back there thinking, he, you know, large and in charge. And so he's back there with Eric and they, by themselves, just the two of them.
Uh-huh.
And Gate, you know, there's just, hey, how you doing and everything. Gate leaned over, did something, and his pistol fell out on the ground. And he goes, excuse me, son, can you hand me my pistol? And then Clapton's like, it's kind of like horrified, you know, it's like grabbing it.
I can just imagine
just,
that scene.
And, you know, giving it to him. And then we heard this from the crew, from the sound crew later, and said that he was just so enamored by the whole thing. He goes, I got to get him out on tour. We got to, you know, because he knew of Gate and
sure.
he knew of everything, all the years of playing and everything, but he was like, I got to get him out there.
And that was kind of when Clapton was kind of changing his genre a little bit, wasn't he?
A little bit. I mean, he changed it up, and a lot of it was his beginning of recovery and
right.
and doing all that.
Right.
And So, and he was, and that was another thing that was good that you were lucky because they really did not let people near him.
Well,
because,
you told me, yeah. I don't know that anything's going to come of this. You can be backstage with us and hang, but I'm not sure what's going to happen.
I can't guarantee anything. I said, if it happens, it does. If it doesn't.
So it's really just a long shot, I guess.
So how we ended up after that, I mean, we went from just being, I was torn with gait to, it was just so crazy because, wife was pregnant and 8 months. Yeah. And I mean, it's just going out on tour. Everything was right. Well, we went from nothing to 10. We're going to be in 38 days or 40 days, we're going to be in Scotland doing starting the Clapton tour and worked our way down to Royal Albert Hall. So it was just... It was so crazy. I didn't know anything about it. All I knew was we were on tour, then we had to fly over, and then we're starting this tour with Clapton, and which was just amazing. It was the most incredible thing. And one of my biggest idols was Steve Gadd, was the first person that I met when I walked in there, and he's like the world's, to me, he's the world's greatest drummer. I mean, I just love, Steve Gadd. And when I opened the door, he was standing right there, and I was like, oh, my God, it's Steve Gadd standing there. And so, but anyway, didn't know what was going on. Anyway, we worked our way down to Royal Albert Hall. We played Royal Albert Hall for almost 2 weeks, like 10 days or maybe a little more.
Yeah.
And didn't know anything about the tour at all. Didn't know anything. And I'm still just all in awe and enamored. I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
what
like
is
a kid
happening
in the candy
here?
Store. Yeah.
And so I get home, and then literally a day after I get home, I have Danielle, the kid. Yeah. And then 10 days later, we're back going to Europe to start the European part of the
tour.
And all I know is when we're in the hospital, the nurse goes, "Do you have your baby book?" And I'm like, "What the hell's a baby book? I have no idea about nothing."
Yeah, exactly. I barely know how I got to this point of being a dad.
I'm like, hey, wait a minute. What are you talking about? All I had was a program from the tour book.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'll just get to where all the dates are and let's just, because you got to put your footprints in there. I'm like, I didn't know anything about that. So we got the program and put the footprints in it. And so I said, oh, cool. Got it. Done. I said, well, maybe I can get them to autograph it. I think it'd be kind of cool. So I'm on the plane going to Frankfurt, and we're going to start the second part of the tour. And I just have to actually, for the first time, look at the program. And I'm reading it, and it says, "From the Cradle." And yeah. I'm like, wow, I didn't know what the name of the tour was, the album, I knew nothing.
Right.
And then after I'd already been playing there, and it's like, I realized this is from the chorus. So anyway, we get there, and then I said, hey, I got this, can we, get the autograph? And I got the whole crew, I got Eric, I got Gate, I got everybody autographed. I got one with just Gate and Eric's autograph, and then I got one with everybody.
Ah.
And so they nicknamed her Footprint. And so that's how that whole thing came about. And which on my phone, I still have, you can look and see her little footprint.
The
program.
Cool.
So it was such a cool thing.
She'll treasure that forever.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I have the photo of when we were, after we did the drum in Austin, we were in Houston at which is now Joel Osteen's place now.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, we're there. We take photos. We went in the back, and then I had him take Eric took pictures with Danielle and the couch with him, and then I sat with him and got that. So Danielle just grabbed one of the photos I had with a frame and everything. She just took it yesterday.
Oh,
and,
wow. Oh, my gosh.
She didn't have that one.
And talk about a full circle moment. Eric is about to be a grandfather for the first time, so I have to bring that up. And so now his only child, his only daughter, is pregnant and due
sometime in January, like 23rd. Actually, it was supposed to be February, but they're thinking
they're moving it up a little bit into January. Yeah. And so, so it's got that whole thing is getting ready to come full circle for you.
Which, Clapton is coming, and so we might try to.
Oh, how cool would that be? Another full circle moment. Oh my gosh, that would be so awesome.
So it was great. So that whole thing was pretty crazy. And I mean, it's like that, this whole business thing of ups and downs, one minute you're just, slumming in a place, nobody's there and you're just playing. Yeah. And then the next minute you're doing
on
something
stage
really
for,
crazy.
And however many thousands of
and
people.
It's been like that for the last, 30
Yeah,
years,
I know. So. It's so crazy. I know, besides, obviously, I know Clint Black, I know Gate Mouth Brown, I know Eric Clapton. You played with Allman Brothers for a while, too, didn't you?
I played with on stage with them a few times.
Okay, cool. And then the Jackson 5 or?
Well, Tito Jackson,
okay.
From the Jackson 5. Okay. Was doing some stuff with him, and we were trying to revive the B.B. King band. And after BB died, we all met because Tito wanted to go to where BB is and the museum and the whole bit because BB's buried right at where the museum is, the whole area, and which right down the street is the club that he owned. And so he wanted to do the whole experience, and we ended up somehow worked it out where we were trying to put the band members, a lot of the ex-band members of BB together and then with Tito and kind of doing that whole thing. So I got to go do a bunch of dates with
That's
Tito.
Cool.
And that was, I still think about it. It's just wild, when I have to go, somebody wants to hear a Jackson 5 to him and say, man, I was playing with that guy.
I know. It's crazy. Well, I still feel bad. I don't remember who you were playing with. I want to say you were playing in New York with somebody, and I had been a huge fan of the Counting Crows at the time. And you got me Adam Duritz's signature from the Counting Crows.
Yeah.
And
I was just talking to Danielle yesterday.
I can't find it. I lost it somehow. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so sad. I was just like, I treasured that always, and I don't know where it is. So.
Yeah, I still got the photo of he and I took a photo together, and I still got that.
Oh, do you? Did he sign that?
Yeah. Which,
take a picture and send it to me.
the funniest thing is that I didn't have any of my stuff. I got divorced, and I didn't.
I understand.
Was told that everything was burned and thrown away and all that stuff. Yeah. But come to find out, it was all there. So I got all my everything.
Oh, you got it back. Oh, that's so cool. I did not realize
back.
That.
Oh,
super cool.
I got everything back.
Very cool.
And it was all good.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I feel like it's so interesting how your career's evolved in the music industry, but you were, I think, since almost birth, deaf, you're
right
deaf
ear.
In your right ear, and you only have partial hearing in your
I've got pretty good hearing in my
your
left.
Yeah,
oh yeah. I mean, I can hear things, and that's,
Well, I knew you had some hearing, obviously, or you couldn't even be doing what you're doing, I don't think. But, I mean, how have you had to, have you had to make adjustments, or how do you, adapt?
I do it to where nobody knows that I would not sit here. I would be sitting there.
I know that, because I know... I'm your bad ear is to me, and I know that because I know whenever we talk, you will turn your good ear toward
people want to sit directly in front of them, and I'm always sitting going to the right, and they're like, what are you doing?
Because you've got to have it to your good ear.
I have to, I do, and I try not, I don't say anything about it, I don't do anything about it, it's just what it is.
Does that impact where you stand on stage?
You'll notice most of the time.
No, I figured
on the
it did because I know
stage.
You're always at the same place, more or less, on stage.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to know if that was a conscious,
Oh, it's definitely done deliberate.
I thought so.
It's very
yeah.
deliberate. There is some things. I mean, I've gotten older, and so I don't hear.
You have? I haven't.
Well, my ears have. Let's just say my ear has.
I understand.
So I don't hear as good as I used to on the, but I can still on the real high end, but I've still got pretty good hearing, and this, for some reason, it allowed me to hear things that most people don't hear.
Yeah.
Frequencies. And when they're
it's kind of like super, like it's like when you have a deficiency, it's almost like you're hyper good in other ways. And so it kind of compensates, right?
Yeah. With the hearing thing, it's, you know, unfortunately, like if let's say if somebody's in a room or if something noise happens, I have no idea where it's at.
Got it.
And the reason why is because when sound hits you, it goes in your right ear first and then travels to your left ear.
Is that right?
And the milliseconds it takes between that is where we perceive where things are in a room. And
interesting.
That's, yeah. So it's so I can't, because I don't have that reference.
Yeah.
I mean, and we're talking, I mean, like, not even
extremely
milliseconds.
Short period of time. Just, yeah.
But the brain, that's how we're able to do distance and where we know where things are.
Yeah.
I can't hear that. So if I hear, you know, it's like you push the button for your keys, you know, like to find your keys or your phone or your watch or whatever. It's like I can hear it go off, but I can't tell you what room it's in.
Right.
I, you know, until I start walking around, I can hear it get a little louder. Then I know I'm getting close.
You're getting warm.
You know, but I can't hear. You know, if you know, and then because of that, I've had to always really good things about it is it makes me when I listen to something, I focus ultra focus.
Yes.
So I'm very intent
locked
in hearing everything because if I don't,
you're gonna miss it.
Or I'll let some, you know, and the fun thing is when somebody that you don't really want to talk to, a drunk person comes up,
turn your right ear to them,
they, you know,
they don't have a clue.
And I'm like shaking my head, yeah, like, oh, yeah,
sure, whatever.
But then you have the ones that are drinking, and it's like they just want to, you want to hear what they're wanting to say, you're trying to. Move your head, and they follow your right ear around, and I can't, you know, I'm like,
so that you can still not hear what they're saying.
So, but no, it's been a, you know, a good thing and a bad thing.
Yeah.
But I think for the most part, it's really been a good thing that for me, like I said, I was able to hear. I still get called to go listen to in the studio on to help mix, and because I'll hear frequencies that they're not hearing that
right,
are a problem.
Right, exactly. And it's like your right, your good ear, your left ear is like your superpower, kind of.
Yeah,
yeah. And no, so, I get that.
And I think, like I said, the ultra focus thing. Now, the negative thing is I could be standing, if I'm paying attention to something, you could be standing right where you are and yelling at me, and I won't hear you.
Uh-huh. I understand.
And
my husband says the same thing about me. I just don't think I have the same hearing problem you do. I have a different one.
So that gets a little frustrating because they think, oh, you're just deaf. And I'm like, no, it's because I'm really focused
on something. Yeah,
it's super
hot. Yeah, absolutely.
And because I don't have it coming into my ear, and I'm concentrating, if I'm talking to somebody or, you know, it just makes it really tough. But
well, and I think you and I both, I mean, I don't have the same hearing problem. I definitely have a hearing problem. I don't have the same kind of hearing problem you do. But I think we both, to a certain extent, I think even when I was in high school, I mean, as a younger girl, I literally was always so hyper-focused on whatever I was paying attention to that people would always tell me that whether they would pass me in the hall or pass me on the highway, and they would be waving, and they're like, literally, they're like, you are in your own world.
Yeah.
And my husband Dave is always saying, you are going to be murdered at the gas station because literally you are so clueless as to what is going on around you. Someone will come up from behind you and stab you and you will just be gone. I mean, and I'll be just still talking, you know, but I understand what you're saying about getting hyper-focused on something and not really being able to hear the noise from other, you know, directions.
I won't hear things, but I always, you know, in that kind of vein, I've find that I'm always looking around me, I guess just because I've been in some really sketchy situations that I've had to learn.
You have reason to look around you. Definitely.
But it does. But when you're focused on something, somebody can yell at you and you won't.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. So tell me, what would you describe the kind of music that you play? I mean, you've played with a lot of different types of artists, and certainly you have your own band as well.
Right.
So, and I know you play a lot with other musicians as well. And so do you kind of morph, and does your playing style change depending on who you're playing with?
Oh, yeah. No, it definitely does. I change up. You know, I'm a sax player, so I'm going to be playing sax, and you can't change that.
Sure.
But, you know, you're not going to be playing let's say you're playing a 50s rock and roll thing. You're not going to go and play some John Coltrane jazz thing.
Right.
Which I hear guys do, and it just drives me insane.
Right.
Because you play in the vein that you're playing.
Sure.
And I play the style. If I'm playing with a guitar player,
yeah,
I will play, you know, that style that he's playing.
Sure. You adapt, basically.
I'll change it up. It's still me, and I'm still doing what I do, but I make it work into what they're doing. So I definitely change it up. And
what kind of music would you say the Eric Dimmer Band plays? How would you describe that?
I mean, it's blues, but it's not blues. It's blues rock.
Yeah.
It
does,
but funk.
To me, it definitely has a rock component. It definitely has a funk component.
It's just
component.
Very edgy, high energy.
Yeah.
Edgy.
Yes.
And just, you know, wild sax screaming, hollering.
Yes.
Driving
yes.
everybody crazy kind of stuff.
Yeah,
so,
absolutely. Absolutely.
You know, I've listened to a lot of great sax players. And so everybody, you know, the one thing, I guess if I had to describe myself to somebody, if they wanted to know, I'd just say, well, if you listen to Saturday Night Live, people always come up and say, man, you just sound like Saturday Night Live. And so that's really kind of the best way to just.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got to play with Lenny Pickett, who's the sax player now. Actually, I've played with, there's only one that I haven't played with that was on the show. I forget his name, but he was the one sax player that played when G.E. Moon was the lead on the show.
Uh-huh.
But,
was that the lead back when it was Bass-O-Matic and all that kind of stuff, or was that afterward?
The first sax player was Lou Marini.
Okay.
And who was from the Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
And who
yeah.
actually got to
Is that
play
back
with.
When it was like Dan Aykroyd and
that
all those
was,
guys?
Yeah, that
okay,
was
that's
the
what I
original,
thought. Yeah.
The original cast, he was in there for a while. And then in the 80s, David Sanborn.
Oh, yeah.
Was the sax player.
And you
player.
Met David Sanborn, too, didn't
got
you?
Got to be good friends with him.
Yeah, and, yeah. I remember that.
I was talking about that last night. Had a, you know, he was really good friends, and there's a lot of funny stories about him and me and stuff. And it was really crazy. One night, not too long ago, I had a dream. And so one time that I did play with him was in Switzerland. We were at the Montreux Jazz Fest in Switzerland one year. And so he was getting ready to play, and one of the keys fell off his horn. And then the pads were falling out and everything.
During the performance?
No, right before he was
going
on stage.
Oh, before. I was like, oh, my
literally,
gosh.
He was going to go out on stage, and the Wooly Roach was his road manager. He and I were just kind of laughing at him and saying, wait, what are you doing? You know, because he loved that horn. That was his special. And he was very, very
particular
that and what's the word I'm thinking of, just he's got his own idiosyncrasy,
uh-huh. okay.
kind of weird things
yeah.
that, you know,
wants things a certain way
and almost
but don't you find most musicians do?
I'm getting, as I'm getting older, I'm getting pretty bad about that myself, so
I just hate to hear you're getting older. It just sucks.
Well, I'm not really. I am in number, but you know, I mean, I'm out there, I'm working harder than
I
any
know,
of those guys. Than
I
Matt
know,
Kirk
I don't know how you do that,
playing
night
with,
after
so.
Night.
So, I mean, I'm still doing it, and I won't stop.
That's
and,
awesome.
But anyway, with the Sanborn thing, so I was, a couple of I'll try to make them quick. One of the things was early on with Gate, we were out in Los Angeles playing at the B.B. King Club, the grand opening of the club. And there was a reporter that came out from the Hollywood Reporter, did a review on the show. And they were talking about Gate, and then they started talking about me. And it said, you know, wild sax, screaming sax stuff. makes David Sanborn sound like a schoolboy eating pie is on the actual
review. Right. Oh, and I kind of remember that.
So I had it, and then Dave was playing in San Antonio, matter of fact. And so I went. I was off that night. I came to town just to kind of hang out. And so we went to his hotel room the next day after the show. And it's funny because he's in his robe. He's in the hotel, and Danielle goes in there, and he's trying to get her food. And I'm just waiting on her hand and foot, you know, and she's real little. And so I said, hey, Dave, man, I got something for you to check out. I said, there was a review between you and me. And he goes, oh, they were ditching you for me. And I'm like, not really. You know, and
I got to hear this. What was his take on it?
So I just said, here it is, you know. And he started reading it, and he just kind of laughed. He said, you got to be kidding me. And I said, now you got to autograph it. And so I did. I mean, he did. He actually autographed it. And so we'd always been friends, you know. Every time I'd be running to him. We're in France somewhere.
Cool.
We're all in some of the same festivals and everything. So I'd gotten to know him pretty well. And just not too long ago, you know, I had a dream. It was just really weird because we were in a doctor's office, and we were just sitting there talking. And just don't know how that came about, but he's showing me this new horn that he got. It was like a real special. I mean, it was really special horn. I think that Selma or somebody had gotten him. And he goes, hey, you want one? You know, want it? And I'm like, I can't afford that. And he says, sure you can. And I said, no, I can't afford that. There's no way. He goes, well, here. Yeah, he was giving it to me. And then he got called to go into the doctor's office. And it was so real. It was the craziest dream that I'd ever had. Woke up the next morning and found out that he had died. So it's just one of those kind of weird. And one of those weird things, you know, we were giving him a hard time about his horn all those years ago.
Oh my gosh, that's so crazy.
So yeah, I'd had a dream about him the next day that I found out that he died. So it was just, you know, that was just kind of a crazy hard. That was, you know, he was, you know, really. I mean, he was the reason why I play sax.
I remember he was such an idol.
There was, the song "Sad Cafe" by the Eagles on the Long Run album.
Yeah,
somebody said you ought to learn that. And when I heard, I didn't know anything about Sanborn or any sax players. I didn't know anything. And when I heard that, it just kind of destroyed me. It just hit a nerve in me that I was just like, I got to learn this, I got to learn it. Then it was like. To learn everything about what he did and the way he played and the style and then I started to think he was the reason why I'm playing.
Yeah, no, I totally get that.
So anyway, it was, you know, like I said, I've had some really cool stuff through the years.
Yeah,
I got to be around
absolutely.
Some really great players. You know, Santana, got to, you know, hang out with him. You know, there's been just,
I know, it's incredible. All the
I forget about half the people.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that list is just so distinguished.
Forgetting all the stuff, you know.
And so long. The list is long. But tell me this. If you didn't do music, which I know that's the path that you've taken, what would you have gone back and done? If you had to do it over and you could not do the music route, what do you think you would have done?
Chef. Yeah. Chef.
Interesting.
Stuff. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very cool. I love that. I did not know that. That's a very cool thing.
No, I would, you know, and that's still, you know, it goes with music. It's the same.
Yeah.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
For me, like I can taste something. I can tell you what's in it.
Sure.
I just know. Yeah. I know all the.
It's an art. Cooking is an art.
It's an art.
Just like
and
music
so
is.
It's you use a
on
lot
the
of
creative
the same,
side of
yeah,
things.
You use a lot of the same.
That's so cool.
Whether it's learning frequency or learning, you know, sound, you know, how to put things together and whatever. It's just, it's a lot of the same. So I have a lot of that same stuff. And
what's your favorite thing you like to cook?
Any kind of meat. That's what I'm best at. Yeah. But, you know, whether it's, you know.
Do you like to barbecue or you like more to the grill or?
The thing with the barbecue is, you know, like I said, getting older, and you don't want to sit there for hours and hours and really watch your firebox.
Yes.
That's just, that's a pain.
Yeah.
And so I did it for a long time. I would do that because people would hire me to do like turkeys and stuff like that for Thanksgiving.
Yeah,
and
for big events.
I would do all that. And I hate because I had to constantly watch it. Now you've got all these pellet grills and you just like set it and forget it.
I know everything's so automatic and controlled and all that kind of stuff.
I've thought about getting one.
Yeah.
It doesn't, whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And, it's really the quality of the food.
Yeah. That's true. That's so true about anything.
With
it relates to cooking. To me, if you don't have a good quality of food that you're working with, it's going to be a challenge to put something really good together.
You know, it's not the real Wagyu, but like in beef, you know, when you've got, even the American Wagyu, it's different. The actual meat to me is just, it tastes totally different than others.
True.
And I've been doing burgers and the burgers come out so good.
Yeah.
And not even grilled and just even in a skillet, I've done them and they're just, they're better than anything that I've
You're
ever
done. Making me hungry.
I
can hear everybody's collective stomachs grumbling.
it's hard to go out to dinner. It's hard to go to a restaurant
because when you can cook so good at home, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
And there's not much that can't do.
Yeah,
my first job I ever had was at Godfather's.
Godfather's Pizza. I know because I used to have to drive you there sometimes.
Yeah,
I do remember that Godfather's Pizza job.
Yeah,
it was over there at Blanco and West.
Something like that.
I think it was at that shopping center, wasn't it?
Or at least
one of the locations I took you to was at Blanco and West.
Yeah, something like that.
So you may have worked at other locations, but that's the one that I remember taking you to.
It's been so long I've forgotten exactly where it was. But
I still have it ingrained in my mind.
I started doing, the pizza, started making pizza before that.
I
was a kid.
I do remember that.
Our grandmother learned to do it, and then she started doing it until the last couple of times, like the dough was raw and everything. It was like, okay,
we need to switch gears here and do something different. My favorite part of the podcast, favorite part of the episode is where we have the feral and fabulous paddle.
If you
will grab it, it's right next to you. So I'm going to give you several different topics.
Oh no.
And you're gonna say whether you think it's feral or fabulous. And of course, you know, as we've talked about before, feral and fabulous, depending on the context and how you say it, it can be either.
We need about four more shots.
we need more tequila. Okay. Your first topic is Indian sacrifice.
Oh, no. that brings me back to when I was a kid.
Exactly. Why do you think I put it on the list? So what's your answer, feral or fabulous? Feral. Okay, I have to just say, when we were young in the neighborhood, we grew up and live in a neighborhood called Inspiration Hills. And we're 6 years apart. So I was always the producer, the director of, we would put these little,
plays,
shows together. And so we would have different topics, and this one in particular, those of you that grew up in San Antonio, back in, was it 1967? I think they had Expo 67. And it was like Hemisphere and they had an Indian type sacrifice where literally they would do this whole thing. And it was a really fabulous show. So I decided we were going to recreate this whole Indian sacrifice at the house in our garage. And so we used the ladder on the bunk beds out of the room as to what we were going to, and Eric played the Indian maiden and we put a wig on his head. And my other brother, who is 3 years younger than me, he and I together were holding the ladder up. And of course we had all the other people dressed up and we were again chanting and we had music going and stuff like that.
Oh my God.
So
yes.
As we were trying to lift him up, we got a little off kilter. We dropped the Indian maiden. So I think he's still traumatized by that all these years later. So I was wondering if you were going to recall that all these years later.
Believe me, nothing.
But it's been a minute or two, so I understand the feral on that. So I totally get that. Okay, I've got another one for you. Outdoor venues.
Ooh, I need two for that.
Okay.
Let's see.
Okay.
I need both for that one.
I get that. Because it can be really cool.
It's great.
Literally.
And then it can, and then it can be.
It can suck.
Yeah. And it can be terrible on both ends of it.
Right.
The cool, it could be too cold. Or it could be way too hot.
Yes.
Not
controllable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, some of those are some of the best. Still, quick story on that with Danielle, and she was, I think she was 10, maybe a little older. I had her playing sax, and so we're doing the Willie Nelson July 4th picnic, and she's there, and I got her to play with us, and she was up there, and she was, there's 30,000-40,000 people out there, and it was packed, and so she was doing okay. I'm sorry, look at all those people out there, She's like, oh. And I said, and then there was a helicopter. I said, that helicopter is going to be filming you while you're playing. And that freaked her out. So that's a good. It's good.
It's both. It can be both. I totally get that. Okay, I've got another one for you. Morgan Wallen.
Oh,
I knew it. I knew this was going to get him.
It really, neither one, but I want to say this because every time I'd want her to come out, oh, we can't because we're going to go see Morgan Wallen. Can you do a Morgan Wallen song?
For those of you that don't know, it's not so much that I have an obsession with Morgan Wallen. It's that my granddaughters, and you will understand this now that you're going to be a grandfather, but I have two beautiful granddaughters who both are obsessed with Morgan Wallen. So, because I am K-Ma, K-Ma has to come through with the Morgan Wallen tickets. And so definitely I have become a huge Morgan Wallen fan.
I'm not knocking because all those
And he did there. Sign our autograph. He signed it. Yes, Vivian and I were together. We went to see him. We've had to see him a few times in order to get him to sign an autograph. But we were down in the pit. I literally almost lost my life. That's a whole nother story. But anyway, we made it. Actually, I say we. That's wrong. Katie, my trusted producer of this podcast, she made the most fabulous, fabulous poster. And literally, we took it to several concerts, which he saw it, but we were too far back for him to actually sign it. And then finally, we were up in the pit, and he grabbed it and signed it. And we have a video of him signing it. So
cool.
I love me some Morgan Wallen. I get it.
And I'm only doing it for that reason.
Not
because of him, because, all those guys, they're out there busting their ass.
Absolutely.
You have to appreciate the work ethic
for sure.
All of them.
Yes.
Even
Taylor Swift, you got to give it to.
I was just getting ready to say.
You got to give it to Taylor Swift because.
They all, to do what they're doing, at the level they're doing, they're busting their ass.
Her last 24/7. Tour, she was singing and choreographing. I mean, all that stuff to 44 songs a night.
Oh, that's.
And back to back for several years.
Oh, yeah.
I have a hard time listening to 44 songs in one shot, sitting down with a cocktail, much less on stage performing and singing under all different kinds of conditions.
Oh, yeah. No, it's rough. And I appreciate all those, everybody. Yeah, might not be what I want to hear.
Yeah.
Unless I'm getting paid to go play.
Yes.
Which I'd love it,
Yeah.
But I respect because it's a lot of work.
Absolutely.
It's like,
for sure.
It's ferociously hard.
For sure.
To do what they do.
Absolutely. Totally agree with you. Completely agree with you. Okay. Train rides. okay. Love it.
it has its moments, but for the most part, everyone that I've ever done, I've loved. Okay. Most have been in Europe, cool. But yeah.
Okay. Final one. You need some water?
I'm good.
Okay. Houston. Ah, I knew it. I would have guessed that. I know you've, how long have you lived there?
Since too 88.
Long? 88, since 88. Okay.
Yeah. And I can't get out of there soon enough.
Yeah.
New Braunfels, I just love it there.
I know.
And every time when I get, you know, anywhere near New Braunfels, I just put the windows down and I just, I start relaxing. My blood pressure goes down. And I'm not as all uptight, and I'm not snapping at everybody because, you know.
We'll find you a good place. I know somebody that can do that. We'll find you a good place in New Braunfels. Cool. So,
yeah, I'm definitely ready to.
Awesome. Make it. Well, I'm ready for it to happen too. So, well, thank you so much.
Thank you all.
For being here. This was such great fun. You and we look forward to having you back again. And I know, do you have any upcoming dates in the future? Because I'm not sure, you know, when this is going to air, but what do you got going, you know, down the road? Like, you have anywhere? Are you going to be in the States, out of the States, like in November, December?
I'm all over. I'll be in Florida, middle part of November. I'm in Florida. I'm back in December. Most of my overseas stuff, I won't go out till, might end up going out. I'm 26, but I've got 27, 28. I'm going back to Switzerland. I've got shows over there.
Okay.
I'm getting called to go do stuff. So
yeah, absolutely.
Still, you know, and whether I'm playing with Matt Kirk, which I've got
absolutely. Here. I love me some Matt Kirk.
And the band is really good. Matter of fact, on October 24th, we're releasing one of the songs he's got called "Without the Dark," which is going to be a hit. It's
so cool.
It's a fantastic song.
I definitely want to have Matt on the podcast. He's so talented. I look forward to that.
Yeah, no, he, you know, and but I tell you what, the band itself is really, it's just a few things need to happen, and then once it does, the band's going to blow up. It'll be
exciting.
So we just got the masters for the live record that we recorded at Green Hall. Cool. And I think they're going to release that in the spring, early spring next year. And but we just got the masters done, and it sounds great. You know, we did it all live there at Green Hall. Cool. And nobody else has got a record out from Green Hall, so...
Yeah,
they're getting ready. Green Hall is putting out 50 years of Green Hall, and which they're going to take one of the songs from and put it on there. So that's kind of a cool thing. Still have we have one or two more shows with Matt at Green Hall, and then we won't be playing there anymore.
Okay,
because we'll be. We've been doing the beer box stage, which is the free show basically. So now we're going into ticketed shows, and that's, you know,
whole different deal.
Yeah. And, it's just what you do. And, you know, Robert O'Kane was the first one that was played the beer box. He's the one that started the beer box stage. And then, next thing you know, he's like, I can't play here anymore. And the next thing you know, he's ticketed shows, and then he became huge. And so, Matt's got a lot of the same kind of thing happening. No. So cool. Look for that, you know.
Absolutely.
And then I'm working. I'm about to get starting to record the new album.
Cool.
So I'm getting ready to get that done on my own. We've been writing songs for it, and so I'm putting that together. And
awesome.
Staying busy.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for
thank
joining
you.
Us.
Appreciate
and
it.
To all you guys out there, just keep on keeping on. Take care.